Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're doing something that I am always happy to do, discussing with various people concerned with the issues of raising the visibility and supporting women in the food, hospitality, and beverage industry. We'll start out with a really hot publication, a hot new publication called Cherry Bomb, interviewing the founders of that. We'll listen to Carrie and Claudia. Well, I was so delighted to encounter a magazine, which is actually so much more than just a magazine, practically a book, and it is a periodical, publishing twice a year, called Cherry Bomb, bomb spelt with the E on the end. And we're going to be talking to creative director, Claudia Wu, and the editorial director, Carrie Diamond. And I just have to start by saying, this is a magnificent publication. Thank you so much for coming across with it.
Oh, thanks, Ann. We're honored.
I'm thrilled a bit. You had a different life. You both met them working at Harper's Bazaar.
We did. Yeah.
But you sort of balance out your strengths. One of you is the art director and the other one is the editorial content. Is that true?
Exactly.
Right.
I think the magazine works well because our strengths are very different. And even our tastes in food and restaurants and all those things are very different. So we really balance each other out.
One of you is a restaurateur as well.
Correct. That would be me, Carrie.
Carrie is a restaurateur. And you have three restaurants in Brooklyn. Right?
I do, with my boyfriend.
Okay, who is the chef?
He is.
And what are those restaurants?
We have a Vietnamese restaurant called Nightingale 9, a Southern restaurant called Wilma Jean, and we have a coffee shop called Smith Canteen. They're all in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn.
Right, so you can walk between one from the other, huh?
Well, you can lose money in three places at once. That's really good.
They're very close to each other. Two of them are right across the street from each other. I never know how these chefs do the restaurant. They've got one in Paris and one in Tokyo and one in New York and Las Vegas. That would make me crazy.
Oh, I'm telling you, they're in the air constantly, which is,
yes.
There is so much content in each one of these. As I say, you only put out two a year. They're jammed with content. Well, first of all, let's go through the process. Whatever possessed you to launch this magazine?
We're just crazy.
Come on. You must
have
had
some.
That's
a good answer.
You must have had a thought process directing you to do this.
Well, Claudia, this is Claudia's second independent self-published magazine.
Okay.
She had a magazine before this called Me Magazine.
So I'm extra crazy. I knew what I was getting into.
And so I had wanted to do a food magazine based around one of my restaurants, actually. We were getting all these offers to do cookbook, but that just wasn't that exciting or appealing to us. So I said, what if we do an annual magazine? My boyfriend liked the idea, and I said, let me call Claudia, because I was a big fan of the magazine that she was producing. And so we just started hanging out and talking, and the magazine went from one direction to a completely different direction, and the name Cherry Bomb just popped out of thin air, and it stuck, and it really describes what we're trying to do with the magazine.
Well, what does it mean that you're trying to do it with the magazine Cherry Bomb?
Oh, so many things. Claudia, you want to start?
This is one of my, I've been harboring this question since I saw the magazine.
Where does the name come from? Well, I guess Lucky Peach at the time was like changing the way that food magazine book, and Cherry Bomb was kind of like, we kind of wanted to be like the girl version, because Lucky Peach is very male-centric, let's just say.
It's sure testosterone loaded.
Yes. Yes, so it came out of that a little bit. And the name's just like a song.
So there's a song by Joan Jett and the Runaways called Cherry Bomb.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's a firework.
Okay.
It's
also a pastry. You're right. Bomb. Yeah. I never thought of it, actually.
Right. So all of that just sort of lent itself to being something feminine but disruptive and delicious. Say, all those three things in one.
Okay.
The thing that's amazed me so far in the conversation is that you decided to take on David Chang in the marketplace.
Well, that wasn't the only reason. I mean, that
sounds a little bit like suicide.
Well, we're all friends at the end of the day, but I think that we were definitely, without realizing it, we tapped into something much bigger that was going on, and that there were all these women in the food world really not getting the kind of recognition that they deserved. And we just thought that there were so many amazing stories out there that needed to be told, and Claudia and I like being storytellers. Claudia approaches it from a very visual sense, and I approach it from words, and we just love helping people tell their story.
This has been an ongoing thing since way back when we started the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. Gone on since, when was that?
Well, that was years ago, but we just had this conversation just a few days ago talking about women in the wine business.
Women in the White House?
In the wine business.
It's a business called a woman's palate. Do you know that one?
I mean, in the White House, the woman's in charge. This is different.
Very funny. No, I don't. I've never heard the term women's palate.
A woman's palate is the name of this business that started by Susan Citron and her partner, who is she from Bordeaux or Burgundy? France. And what they do is they have a list of women-owned wineries that they help promote, and then they have on the other side, since women actually purchase more wine than men, percentage-wise, they have educational classes to teach women about wine. So anyhow.
We'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's interesting. Anyhow, if you want any information, just ask me and I'll give it to you.
Okay.
So, you seem to be kind of all over the board with who you select. How do you go about making these editorial decisions?
That's a good question. We always have a theme, which makes it easier.
So the one that has a picture. So the one that has a picture of, is it one of you on the cover, holding an apple?
That's an actress.
Oh, that's an actress.
I don't think our pictures ever run in the magazine.
Oh, okay, all right.
So the latest one. What is her name? She's wonderful, by the way. What is she?
Oh, Kristen Kish.
Yes. Did she win the Iron Chef?
Top Chef.
Yeah, and the latest one is another woman named somebody Lou. Just won.
Oh, who just won the other night.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's three, though. And how long has that show been running? And only three women have won.
I think this is the 12th season.
12th, yeah.
You see, that's what we're all dealing with here. Not to mention the wonderful covers of the Food and Wine's Best New Chefs, where they have the nerve to photograph them, and at most two women out of the whole lineup of the dust or wherever they are. But anyhow.
Get off your soapbox.
I'm in my soapbox. Okay,
and we didn't know that's your soapbox, so you must really do like the magazine, because that's
of course I do.
What we're all about.
I was going to have you just verbalize your mission.
So you can now climb onto your soapbox.
I think we've been pretty clear on it from the beginning, and it's to celebrate women in and around the world of food who are doing really interesting, amazing, and inspiring things.
Okay, so this fits in nicely with the current Food and Wine thing, Women Who Inspire?
Yeah, exactly.
And again, I'm still not sure how you go from one thing to the other, just loaded with information and events. Do people start, at this point, they probably start sending you all kinds of PR info, right?
Yeah, we say that a lot. We get a lot of emails.
And is there a final decision on what's included, and how does that happen?
It happens by consensus. Yeah, it happens by consensus. Like, we'll sit down and go over the lineup for each issue, and some things don't make it, but, you know, sometimes the timing's not right, but we basically sit down and, like, put all our ideas down, and it just goes from there.
You mean like a little storyboard thing? About, you know, you paste all your ideas and then sort of take them down one at a time?
Almost. We have an electronic version of that on a spreadsheet. But it is hard. Claudia and I have said this a lot of times, that we could very easily do an issue a month with all the great stories that are out there. And it's almost painful in a way to do each issue, because there are so many people who we essentially leave out. You know, we'll get to telling their story at some point, but it's hard. There are only so many people you can feature in the magazine in each issue, and like you said, it's already such a big, thick issue that we definitely do cram as many people in there as we can. Our conference is sort of the same. We probably squeeze way more speakers into our one-day conference than the average conference, because there are just so many people we want to put the spotlight on.
Yeah, tell me about this. I mean, this created quite a splash last year. It's called the, what's it called? Jubilee? And last year you had...
It's a play on Cherry's Jubilee, I guess.
Yes.
Right? Hey, I got that. How about that? and I'm only a guy. I mean, I'm feeling outnumbered here as it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was... You drew A-listers for the whole conference. I mean, that was an amazing first out of an event.
It was amazing first out. Claudia came up with the name, so it's all because of Claudia.
But everybody was receptive, right?
Yeah, I think you can say that. The first conference was great. I mean, I have to be honest, the whole thing was sort of such a blur. It came about because Time Magazine did that whole Gods of Food issue.
That horrible thing,
and I'm sure you were not happy about that.
No, it was pathetic. Absolutely pathetic.
That's one way to put it. So that came out, and Eater.com, the food industry website, did some really good reporting on it. And they have a young woman who's a reporter there named Hillary Dixler. And Hillary did a story about the female chef participation in all these different food conferences around the country. And she discovered what most of us knew, that there weren't a lot of female chefs or food people being included in these conferences. And then Gabrielle Hamilton gave a really interesting interview to The New Yorker, and she mentioned that she's not even being invited to the conferences. And that was kind of shocking to us. And, I mean, Claudia, you can correct me, but I think we were talking about maybe doing a conference in a few years. Like, we definitely weren't. We'd bitten off more than we could chew, and we weren't really prepared to do anything other than the magazine. But it was clear that somebody had to do something. So we talked about it. We were like, let's see if somebody else decides to do a conference, and no one did. So we said, let's do our own, and then Claudia came up with the name, and it really summed up everything that we wanted to do. Jubilee is a celebration, just like the magazine. So it was the perfect name.
Well, it was, as I said, a resounding success, and your next one is coming up. Give us, our listeners, the info on that. Is there a, give us the dates and how to find out the information about it.
It's on March 29th at the Highline Hotel in New York, and tickets just went on sale today, actually. You can find more information about it on our website, which is www.cherrybaum.com. But yeah, we just posted the lineup, and yeah, we're really excited about it.
Anybody interesting coming on?
Everybody's interesting.
Yes. What's the theme?
The same as last year. There is no theme.
Okay. All right. I'm looking at the issue of Cherry Bomb. It's number 3 with Ruth Reichel on the cover, and then the one, number 4. You said there is a theme for each issue. What are the two themes here?
Ruth was Girl Crush, and Kristen
Gould.
Theme
for the Kristen Kish issue is New School, Old School.
Oh, okay. Very good. Are you already working on the next one?
Yes, we are kind of behind on that, but it's been progress.
Just to give our listeners a taste of some of the material you cover, give us an idea of some outstanding articles that you've done and photo shoots and stuff.
Boy, I mean, for me, I wonder if we've never talked about this, so I wonder if we have different ones. Honestly, people say stuff like this all the time, but each story is like your child can't really pick a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if I was forced to pick a favorite, I really did love the Alice Waters story that we did in the second issue. That was the baked theme.
Uh-huh.
And we reached out to a lot of the women who were sort of in the Cherry Bomb circle, I guess you could say, and we asked them what they would ask Alice. So, you know, the song in the book, Go Ask Alice. So we had each of them give us a question, and we went to Alice's house and sat down with her and had a lovely chat, and we were able to ask all these people's questions, and they ranged from really serious questions to what does she eat in an airport and on an airplane.
She packs
her
lunch.
She brings her own food.
Yeah, everybody does, yeah.
So that was one of my favorites.
Okay. Any others you want to bring up? I just want our listeners to get a sense of the kind of material that you publish.
We worked twice with this great team in London. The photographer is Catherine Leasing, and Ian Graham is, I guess, the food stylist. But they did a really great story for us where they made designer cakes. So they had, like, Burberry, they did the Fendi logos, they did a Chanel quilted fruit pate, and Catherine photographed all of them very, very beautifully. So that, I love that story.
Yeah, they do taxis like that over there. I mean, there's a Burberry cab. Full
livery. Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah.
But Dan, there's a real mix of stories. We do a lot of profiles on different women like Ruth Reichel, like Alice Waters. They would be the more established women that we write stories about. But then there are a lot of up-and-comers as well. Like, there's a young woman named Erin McKenna who opened a vegan, gluten-free bakery here in New York City, and she actually has expanded now to Disney. She's opening up a bakery in Disney, which is amazing. And we run a lot of recipes from both established chefs and up-and-coming chefs. We have a lot of great photography. And then we have a lot of stories that probably couldn't get elsewhere about where sort of food and culture come together, I guess you could say, like the story that Claudia talked about. Mm-hmm. We write about different art exhibits that include food, different artists that are working with food as their medium. So it really runs the gamut. The common denominator throughout the issue is inspiring women, but we sort of approach that from lots of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And one thing you might not have realized is we primarily have female contributors as well. Most of the women, most of the writers and photographers are women.
Right. And I was going to ask how you support the magazine, because you don't take advertising.
It's not that we don't take ads. We'd love to take ads.
Oh, you would? Okay.
Sure, sure. It's a small circulation magazine, and a lot of advertisers are looking for much bigger circulation. And then we're also kind of picky about the kind of advertising. We'd never take an ugly ad, and it would also have to be a brand we believe in.
Uh-huh.
You know, you would never in a million years see us take a cigarette ad or something like that.
Right.
But we...
And of course, there couldn't be any men.
There could be men.
He's feeling left out.
But you have to sort of be untraditional. It's a new media landscape today, so you really have to sort of be untraditional as to how you raise money for something like this. And our magazine is expensive, and
it is. I could tell from looking at it.
$20.
No, I meant it's expensive in terms of
production. It's also very expensive to produce.
Yeah, it's expensive to produce. It's so beautiful.
So we do raise money from sales. A lot of magazines are very cheap and don't make any money from newsstand or subscriptions. They make all their money from advertising. And then we do things like Jubilee. And Jubilee also helps support the printing of the magazine.
Well, I just wish you the best of everything here, and keep us posted on what you're doing next, because we're always interested in what you're doing.
So
anything that we can do that would help, we're happy to do so. And congratulations for going out on a limb like this.
Thanks so much. And how did you get into food? You didn't tell us.
Oh, it's my life. I mean, I've been doing it for years. I mean, I had a restaurant. I've eaten. I was a restaurant, a dining critic, a food and travel writer, the whole thing. So it goes back a long time. The funny thing is, Ruth Reichel and I both have a master's in art history from the University of Michigan.
Oh, how funny.
Isn't that, I don't know why. But anyhow, so this has been ongoing for ages, so, and broadcasting. And we're in our 12th year for this program.
Wow.
In fact, yeah. And I loved seeing a lot of the books and authors we've covered are featured in your magazines.
That's good.
That's good, too. Well, best of luck. And next time we meet, maybe we'll meet in person.
We'd love that.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on the show. We appreciate it.
Well, I love it. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and we're talking next to absolutely a dynamo, Carrie Underley, who is helping other women pursue this career as a butcher. She's a third-generation butcher, if not more than that. I'm trying to remember all the connections she has to butchering. And she tosses around steers like we would toss around bananas, I guess.
Really? I don't know about that.
I think so.
Anyway, I'm still here. Just listeners, in case you're worried that I've taken the day off, I am still here. And I think that certainly Carrie has a way with women in the butchery field, but I think she's a butcher's butcher across both sexes. So, guys, listen up. You're going to learn something, too.
Well, Carrie Underley, I just met you, but I think you're going to be one of the most fascinating people that I have in my friend group.
You always need a butcher.
You're fun.
It's not every day you run across someone whose business is called Muscolo Meat Academy.
It sounds somehow
doesn't sound quite like butchery. It sounds like something that's probably illegal.
Well, I read about you on, was it Eater, I think. I looked up the website immediately because it was talking about your support of women interested in butchering and actually that you were active in attracting women to the butchering industry. And then I found out you have a book called The Art of Beef Cutting, which Peter thought was fascinating. It's subtitled A Meat Professional's Guide to Butchering and Merchandising. You have something called Girls Camp. You are launching a Muscolo Meat Academy. You go around the country teaching butchering. What else do you do?
Well, I think that covers it for now, but I might get bored later. But right now, it's everything training and education, and coming from a long line lineage, I guess, of butchers.
Tell me about that. I mean, is this unusual?
It is. And what's even more unusual is that both of my grandmothers were butchers.
Now, that's unusual.
Isn't it? So on my dad's side of the family, my grandmother, she did butchery on the farm during the Depression. And then my dad became a butcher. And then I, in fact, became a butcher. Just to put my way through college, never thinking it would turn into a career. And then on my mom's side of the family, my grandfather and my grandmother had a butcher shop, and my grandfather trained my grandmother, and I was doing my ancestry, and I actually found a posting in the newspaper that lists my grandmother as a butcher, so I was really excited to see that.
Well, I'll tell you a secret, we decided to go to the town that my cousin, who's into genealogy, identified as where my Italian relatives came from when they came to America. And the name of the town, Butcher, was my grandmother's name, the same name.
Oh, how serendipitous is that? Wow.
Amazing.
She has no butchering skills, however.
I do not know.
if anything needs to be cut up, I get to do it.
But, you know, I used to dissect in biology class.
There you go. Well, that's close to butchering a carcass, a beef carcass.
Could be.
Now, you did say you decided to tackle the hardest end of the butchering business, that somehow lambs and goats and pigs were easy and cows were a little harder.
Cows definitely are a little harder. The sheer size of it is, I think, what's most intimidating, is being able to manipulate a 400-pound quarter of beef. And I think traditionally that's what's probably kept women away from the trade, is because it was just such a physical, powerful industry. But, you know, as we've evolved in modern technologies, we're a little smarter with how we can move our bodies. And I think people start with lambs and pigs and goats because it's smaller, it's not as expensive. But when you work in the butchery or meat cutting field, when you're the best, you're on the beef table. And so for me, it was just an opportunity to document something that I didn't see documented to the detail that I wanted. And I just wanted to start with the most complicated, and I just thought there was the most demand for information about the beef carcass.
Now, in a way, you're on a bit of a mission, Carrie, right?
Yes, sir.
Because mm-hmm. that you say in your book, and rightly so, that the art of butchering almost became a dying thing because of the way that meat is slaughtered and packaged in this country now. Can you explain that and explain what's different about what it is that you do and you train people to do?
Sure. What's happened is this is just the truth of the matter. Nobody wanted slaughterhouses in the back of the neighborhoods or in their communities. And as modern agriculture evolved and became more efficient, I'm from Chicago, so just like when the stockyards and the boxcar trains went away, all of that production became centrally located.
But that's a great background, huh?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So today, so much of our modern agriculture is done in the center of the country, where all the animals are and where the big corporations can produce boxed and prepackaged meat. But what's happening now is people want their meat closer to home. They don't want to travel as far. And it's easy when we're talking, you know, green beans and tomatoes. That's a little easier to figure out how to buy local. But when we're switching how we purchase animals for meat, protein, we don't have the slaughterhouses anymore. So now that puts more pressure on the modern-day spin to butchery, these whole animal butcher shops, to learn that trade again. And there's a big void in our industry to help teach those folks and give them a 9-month curriculum that they can really sink their knife into.
Academy is a 9-month program?
Yes. We're looking to launch this fall in September. We're only going to be taking 12 students. One, because it's an inaugural class and it's going to be intensive. It's going to be Friday through Monday. So it's going to be Friday afternoon, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So that way people can still work. And it's just going to give them the culinary side. So I like to say if in the classroom they cut a pork chop and it's crooked and thicker on one side and thin on the other, the next part of the program will be that now we're going to grill that pork chop and we're going to talk about why cutting meat is so important and how it impacts the consumer. And then these butchers out of our program will know how to cook it, how to prepare it. And then I mentioned before I put my way through school cutting meat. My dad was a great butcher, but he wasn't a great businessman. So I also want to make sure that our students understand how to become business owners, similar to craft beer. All of a sudden, we have craft beer joints on every corner if you're in a major metropolitan area. And we could have these butcher shops, these craft industries in our neighborhoods as well. And we're keeping local jobs, similar to the craft brew industry.
You do several things extremely well in this book. First off, we'll sort of gloss over a little bit, because it's hard to picture. How important is it that you have a picture every step of the way as you cut the carcass up and then you cut the different parts of it? It's kind of hard for our listeners to visualize that since we have no pictures.
Trust
us, listeners. If you really want to see what it's like because you intend to do it for yourself, then there's more of a wonderful opportunity for you to study exactly how to go about that, doing that. And if your piece doesn't come out looking like the one in the book, then you got it wrong. And you can try again.
Butchers, they're very tactile. They're very much visually, you know, they see things visual. And so I did put a lot of imagery in the book to kind of help people process it, because you still have to just get in and do it. I mean, I can put all the pictures in the world in the book, but until you actually touch it and turn the meat and identify these parts, it starts to connect. So I did try to put a lot of photography in there to help the user understand, you know, how to follow as they go.
Now, one of the things that you do extremely well is to show with pictures, if you like, what the various, the really commercial pieces of beef are like.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that fascinating, not because I have any intention of ever buying an ox and slaughtering it, but because it's also extremely helpful in understanding what it is you're buying.
Yes,
sir. So when someone describes a rib steak as a tomahawk rib steak, you understand why that's different than a regular ribeye, and then the difference between a ribeye with the bone in and a ribeye with the bone out. All these fascinating tips. I thought the piece about the fillets, which, you know, a tenderloin or a fillet or whatever you call it, can be a real nuisance to cook because it's thicker at one end than it is at the other.
Oh, didn't you know that?
Well, no, I know that. I know that, and
well,
it makes them rather awkward.
What about your story about cutting the end bit off the roast?
Oh, no, we'll come back to that one. But what Carrie does is she says, but you can work around that real easily by buying two, and you put them thick end to thin end and thin end to thick end, and then you have a uniform size piece of meat.
It works as business
much easier
stuff
to cook
it with all these things. I mean, because she's interested in making sure you have a profitable business.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just talking about tutorial value to someone who's simply buying meat, not cutting it, but actually understanding what it is they're buying when they're buying it.
Do you remember where we lived in Australia? I'd go in with my diagram of a lamb. Now, you have to understand, Carrie, that a whole lamb cost about $2 in some sense, Australian. But I went in with a diagram and cornered the butchers, cut it exactly the way I wanted it.
The butchers were suddenly very busy. Anytime
they ran away when I walked in the door.
the lamb was in fact really inexpensive. I think a side of spring lamb was like weighing about 13 pounds, cost $2.
Wow.
So we ate a lot of lamb in those days, and we wish we could get it for that price now.
Yeah.
But then going on from it being useful not only pictorially, but for both the butcher and the buyer, but you also look at the business of what to do with the different parts when you've got it all cut up.
And marketing it, yes.
Tell us some more about that.
Well, I like to say that I'm a recovering retailer. So when after I became a journeyman meat cutter with a independent grocery store in South Bend, I got promoted and I was also responsible for merchandising and buying meat for a profit. So when you'd open up the flyer paper and you'd see the grocery ad in the newspaper, I was behind a lot of making those kind of things happen. And I mentioned before my dad was, I mean, he was a really great butcher, but he wasn't a great businessman. And I think sometimes what happens when we're in love with the craft or the art of butchery, we still have to remember that we have to make money. And I think that's another reason why sometimes these smaller butcher shops fail. So again, my passion and hope that we can also teach these young entrepreneurs, if they're going to go ahead and get into being a butcher, that hopefully they open up their own butcher shop and they have some key ways to measure the success of their business and make sure they're buying it properly and selling it properly.
Now, are you going to be a celebrity butcher like Tom, is it Tom Milan? Who's the Pat LaFreda, all these people? They're all men, but they're all biggest chefs.
Yeah, I know those folks, actually. And one of the things that my other company does is we create the cut chart posters. So when you're talking about the lamb poster going into your butcher, we've created all those for the beef industry.
Uh-huh.
So I get those posters. But funny thing about the Rockstar Butcher phenomenon, I guess you could say, is that it's really just calling attention to the trade. And it's unusual that there aren't any women. I think there was Time Magazine got it.
Oh, that was terrible. Peter and I were talking about that today. The gods of food, please.
I know. When I wrote the book and it was James Beard nominated, which was very exciting for me, it gave me this platform. I didn't really think about what it's like to be a woman in this industry. It was just my industry. And so I've really tried to embrace that other women do need that support because their peers are men. And I've been humbled on how much women really do need that support. And we were speaking before about Women in the Meat Business, the event that we do in North Carolina every year. And it's designed to help farmers and chefs and butchers get together and help create a local meat system so all those people can get together and be the farmer and do what they do well and be the butcher and the chef in the middle that creates wonderful food. But this whole women thing was just really a way to support other women. I do a project with Kate Hill from France, and she was actually the spearhead of it, was Women in the Girls Meat Camp. So we get together, and it's funny how many men want to jump in. You get some funny emails wanting to know if they dress in drag, if they can show up.
And that girl spelled G-R-R-L, huh?
And the answer is no?
Right, because we can spot it. They're not that talented, I think, with their makeup yet, but
Well, tell me this. When you go around, you meet all these people across the country for these camps and the demos you do. Can you give us some idea of the kinds of women who are attracted to, it's strenuous lifting a steer around.
It is strenuous. And I think primarily you're seeing a lot of women chefs who want to add something different maybe to their menu. So if they want to take it more to farm to table and they want to learn, buy a whole animal, you have to sell the snout to the tail.
Yes.
And that's not how we're traditionally trained. You go through an American culinary school, if you will. You don't learn a lot about whole animal utilization. So that's a big part of the workshops we do. It's also about new cuts, coming up with new ways to merchandise things out of hog or the beef carcass that you wouldn't normally think of. I've done a lot of work with the Flatiron steak, the Denver cut.
Yeah.
Oh, great. You were just going towards something we wanted to
ask. I wanted to ask if you know what a salmon cut is.
The salmon cut?
I'm guessing
it's... Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure it's a tri-tip.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
His mother, that's the only thing she ever roasted.
My mother used to buy this particular cut, and the butcher, this is in Britain now, when you ordered a salmon cut, they knew what it was. And I'm really not sure why. I think it was a part of the sirloin, because it was as lean as sirloin is.
You know, it's hard to tell because it was cooked to death.
it was certainly dead when my mother had finished cooking it. but it had so little fat, in fact, that she would buy a slab of suet and string it to the shore meat. And that was the part I used to like to eat. usually didn't have any competition for it. But we looked in the book for a hanger steak and we couldn't find one.
Ah, you're right.
Now, is that because it's called by a different name?
No, you're right, it just wasn't in the book. The hanger steak, there's one per animal, and it hangs on the inside part of the carcass next to the kidneys and the beef suet.
Oh, really?
And so it's making me rethink your idea about the salmon cut, because you mentioned that there was suet around it.
No, my mother, she used to buy a slab of suet entirely separate.
Because it was too dry.
And then she would just strap it to it.
Years ago, the hanger steak would be discarded for waste because it was very close to the kidney. And so they would be discarded. And so now they harvest those and they sell it. So if somebody puts on their menu and they're looking for a sustainable cut, there's only one per cow. So it's probably not the best cut to promote.
Got it.
Because
there
just aren't that many.
I understand. Yeah, I understand.
They're like, in your dreams, do you have like international women's butchering competitions?
In my dreams, I think that would be amazing.
Me too.
Let's go for the 2020 Olympic Games.
Let's do it.
but seriously, listeners, this is a profound piece of work for all the reasons that
the
we described.
Book, and then what about her and all that she's doing?
And you know, the funny part about it is I didn't even want to open it. I thought, boy, this is going to be a really boring book, and it turned out to be absolutely opposite.
We've gotten a lot of books on butchering lately, last few years.
Okay.
So, some of them are not really very interesting, although there are some really interesting ones, too.
Anyway,
and
Carrie,
this is one of them, Carrie.
Yeah, you're to be congratulated.
How do people come in? Let's just give the website.
My website is rangepartners.com, and you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Carrie Underly. I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay.
And the book is available on Amazon, and if you're interested in becoming one of our Muscolos, you can always visit MuscoloMeatAcademy.com.
Right.
Well, we wish you a lot of success, and we'll be looking forward to a whole new generation of ladies behind the butcher's counter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know what? I'm just so happy to have met you and encountered you. I don't know how it's taken so long, Carrie.
Well, thank you. This has just been pleasant, and I've enjoyed spending my time with you.
Right, and let's do it some more.
Okay, let's do it.
Touch base with how your academy takes off, huh?
Okay, definitely.
Okay. Thanks,
right.
Carrie.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And now we're going to be talking to actually a very dear friend of mine I've known for years. We're going to be talking to her about her latest venture. It's called A Woman's Palette. I've known Susan Citron since the early 90s. It's a long time, Susan.
It is.
Now, all this time, though, I knew you were a crack salesperson. I knew you were a crack cook. I knew about you making little weenies, but I never knew that your first love was wine. And now you have a company which deals with women vintners called A Woman's Palette. It may also for all I know, deal with what it says, a woman's palate being the consumer, the end consumer. Tell us what motivated your starting this company and what exactly a woman's palate is, mission, and so forth.
Well, Anne, thank you for having me on talking with you today. And I guess it was a great secret, but hopefully it is no more, a woman's palate. A woman's palate was started, like many good ideas, over a glass of wine with a very dear friend. And we both had spent our junior years abroad many, 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 many years earlier, and in college, had gone on to careers, had dabbled in wine, always loved wine and food and cultures from abroad. And she, my business partner, is a vintner in the Napa Valley, Sharon Harris, who owns Rare Cat Wines. But we both had a passion for getting more women, like ourselves, enjoying fine wines. We saw a real gap in the marketplace of women who were drinking better wines. And if you look statistically at the numbers, it's pretty disappointing. Women buy 60% of wines, according to the Wine Institute in the United States, but almost all the wine they're buying is not of good quality. It's what we call beverage wine, everyday wine. So we set out on this mission to create this little company that did educational events and promotional events where we would invite women, especially, who we felt had the means, maybe perhaps a professional need, and certainly a personal interest, to learn more about fine wines and to drink better wine. That's basically what we did.
Do you have classes, or how do you do this?
We have events, and there are two, if you will, signature events that we do on an ongoing basis. One is a seminar called Don't Give Up the Wine List. And this was really Sharon's idea. And the whole purpose behind Don't Give Up the Wine List, we do this with companies and organizations, very often in their offices, anywhere in the United States. Both Sharon and I can do the seminar. And it's all about empowering women to feel confident to make a good wine choice from a wine list anywhere. It's especially geared towards a woman who entertains clients at lunches and dinners and wants to be confident and in control of the business. And having some good working wine knowledge and confidence in this area is a great tool for her to be able to not give up the wine list and to be in control of the business meeting. So we do Don't Give Up the Wine List. We also have boot camps, which are in Sonoma and in Napa, where we bring women into the wine country in very small groups. We cap it at 18 people at a time and we do a series of 3 days of events, educational classes, dinners, lunches, tastings, outings, all geared on an educational level about fine wine. So those are probably our two signature events. Other events that we do with companies, customized events, if you will, when they're looking for a particular featured at a conference, or a special events, perhaps they want to do sort of a special tasting. And in those situations, what we do is usually bring women vintners in market, in D.C., Chicago, New York, and virtually anywhere where we can persuade the women vintners to travel to and do special tastings on a grander scale with them.
Now, on your website, Susan, you have pictures of a fairly large number of successful American women winemakers. Where do they fit in?
So we really sort of have, I think of it as having two audiences, because one audience is the women winemakers and vintners themselves, and the other audience is the businesswoman audience. The winemakers and vintners, many of them have relatively small operations, and each of them may wear many hats. You may have encountered this in your own travels through wine country. So one of the things that we wanted to do was to reach out to the women vintners and winemakers and offer our services to help them market their brands better in the marketplace. Some of the winemakers and vintners you'll see on our website are from very larger operations and very sophisticated operations too, but many of them are very, very small production houses, and they really don't have anyone per se in marketing or anyone helping them get their brand out. So that's something that we do very keenly for a number of our vintners that we work with.
Now, when we talked to Joy Sterling, who we absolutely adore, by the way, we visited Joy and the vineyard And we had the pleasure of having lunch with Audrey and Barry, her parents, which is which was even more exciting. We drank every one of their 10 cuvées from the beginning of lunch to the end. But let me finish. When we were talking, we said, how come you got to be in charge as the president of the company? And she said, I didn't run fast enough. She said I didn't want the job, but my brother didn't want the job either. Now this seems like a reflection on the fact that a woman's palate isn't altogether doing its job. I mean, you would think that she would be like Eileen Crane at Domaine Canaris, who's another great friend, who couldn't wait to be in charge.
Yeah.
Of course, she went on about how she never got paid as much as any of her male colleagues in the same position.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the sad truth. First of all, I love the story about Joy Sterling, and I think that's so...
She's
what
funny.
What a great family. What a great wine family. What a great story. Now it's third generation involved at Iron Horse. All generations living on the property. They truly are sort of wine country royalty. I think of them as wine country royalty. But they're such a lovely, lovely family. And I understand what Eileen was saying about not getting paid and how that all works. And the sad reality, again, like when we looked at winemakers and women in the business who are leading, whether they be vintners, owners, winemakers, even in Sonoma and Napa, which are the leading as far as, not as far as production, but certainly as far as how they're looked upon in the industry, it's less than 15% of people at the helm or at the top are women. So it's a very relatively small percentage of women who are really in those positions, in those wineries.
But that's an American problem as well, because I told you that
absolutely.
We encountered, it's more than 50% of the winemakers in Navarre or Spain are women.
Uh-huh.
And because they have a very special talent to contribute to winemaking.
Isn't that fabulous that Spain has recognized that? And I think I hope that we can get to that point in this country. But it is a widespread issue in the United States.
Spain's also one of the most macho, paternalistic countries in Europe.
Cultures. It is.
Culture.
It's very interesting that that's the case.
How the thing happened in Navarre, I'm not sure. I think it's an oddball. Even for Spain as a whole, I'm sure the statistics would be more similar to the United States. Navarre just happened to be kind of freakish, and perhaps it was because the president of the Navarre Wine Society was a woman herself, and that had something to do with it. I'm really not sure.
Wow.
But
fabulous.
There is an issue, and I'm going to raise this kind of backwards, and then if you don't like the way it comes out, I'll edit it out of the track. We met a really wonderful woman from the Sonoma Valley called Mary. I can't remember her last name, but her vineyard was called Landmark.
Uh-huh.
And it's since been sold, and since the wines are excellent, and it's an excellent product, I'm sure that she made a lot of money, but I did discover how she got into the wine business. It turns out that her husband is an ancestor of the Deere family, which makes green tractors.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
So I think there's an interesting observation here. Perhaps the reason that there aren't quite so many women in charge in the wine business, we haven't mentioned Helen Turley, who I guess is a character in her own right, but it is an issue that it takes quite a lot of capital to really get into the winemaking business effectively. I think, isn't the story go, how do you make $2 million in the Napa Valley? And the answer is you start with five.
Very true. It's a very capital-intensive business. There's no doubt about it. And when you look at it, too, especially taking it into consideration in some place like Napa, where Cabernet Sauvignon is perhaps the most popular and widely grown grape and varietal, and yet from the time you're picking those grapes in the fall to the time when you release the wine produced from them in the bottle could be 3 years later. So there's tremendous capital investment that goes into the business, and it's labor intensive, capital intensive, and truly is a labor of love, I think, for a lot of people. They do it because their heart is in it and they're passionate about it. More so than they're looking to make a lot of money.
But it's wonderful to see people as successful. So we met Anne Colgin, of Colgin, of the Colgin
yes.
Vineyard. We met her and two of her friends in the Jean Robuchon restaurant in Paris.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Oh, how funny.
It was the week it opened, L'Atelier de Jean Robuchon. Uh-huh.
It was the very first L'Atelier.
Sitting right next to us is one of the top wine property owners in the whole of California. And there's another one I was thinking. The Hall Vineyard in St. Helena. Mrs. Hall
yes.
apparently made a lot of money and also is a rather celebrated, I think she's been a U.S. ambassador to several different countries.
Yes, that's correct.
Of course, a lot of them is also in the family, like that wonderful woman from Abruzzo. Was it Abruzzo or Lamarca?
It was Abruzzo.
Yeah, whose father is known for producing great quantities of commercial wine. And she worked with him for a while until she had enough money to set out on her own and start from scratch, doing everything artisanal, building her own. She ripped out all the vines and put in all this new stock. And who was that? What was her name?
Stefania Pepe.
Yeah, Pepe.
But she had a problem, which will be common in California, I'm sure, as well, and in other wine-growing regions in this country. It took her 2.5 years or 3 years or something like that to persuade a bank to make a loan to her.
Well, that is a problem.
So there are traditional role modeling here, if you like.
That does
make it more difficult for.
I won't disagree with you, Peter. I think.
and that does, and it, and there are lots of lady bankers out there. You'd think they'd be more helpful.
But you would think.
But you know, there actually it's a similar problem with chefs, and it's not even just in the U.S. It's throughout the world. They still have an award. In the 50 best restaurants done by Restaurant Magazine out of London, they still have a special award for best female chef, which is, I think, insulting.
It could be looked upon that way, I suppose. And you know, I've done an informal survey with some chefs because, we, as you can imagine, we work a lot with chefs. And there are some events that we do in conjunction with other, such as Fortune Magazine, for their annual Most Powerful Women's Conference, where they usually use a lot of women chefs, and we try to pair our wines from our women vintners with the chefs. And it's interesting. One thing that has come up, I'm not sure it's quite fair, but it makes sense to me, is that women too often are having children, and sometimes having children can get a little bit in the way, really, of these kinds of careers. They're very, very demanding careers that where you have to put in tremendous number of hours, work a lot of nights, work weekends. Harvest in and of itself for anyone is it's a wonderful time of year, but it's a grueling time of year. It's exhausting, and you're often overseeing picking in the middle of the night, sorting grapes by hand at all hours of the day and night. It's just tremendously daunting.
Right.
And I think, especially for women, fair, unfair, biologically cast, I guess we are, that it has been a bit of a problem for some women to make it to the top echelons and to really make it through their careers because of childbearing. Simple as that. They bear the brunt of it. They're typically the primary parents. Pregnancies can be challenging. So be it, I guess, in that regard. But that's why another reason why I think we felt that a woman's palate might be really helpful in just bringing just a little bit more visibility to these women who have dedicated their lives and are dedicating their lives to their industries and who are really exemplary in the industry and who we felt that perhaps we would like to highlight in a greater fashion.
I mentioned off air that we know at least three excellent women winemakers and vineyard owners in Oregon. And one of them is an intriguing story. It's worthwhile to mention it because clearly what's going to make a woman's palate more successful and women winemaking in general more successful is if there are more personalities like Ronnie LaCroute.
Uh-huh.
Ronnie LaCroute, who sounds like she's a French lady, and she is. She was in business with her husband at a winery called Willa Kenzie in Oregon. They are now divorced. She runs the vineyard. He lives on the property, but has nothing to do with the running of it. So I think these are some of the stories which are needed in order for your overall mission to be accomplished.
And I have two.
I would agree.
I have two follow-ups here before we conclude. Number one is, do you think that there is actually a difference as a consumer between a woman's palate and a man's palate because of what I've heard, that women bring a different talent to it? And also, I was so appalled that Eddie Merlot's chain restaurant set off to make their steakhouse appeal to a woman's palate. I was a little appalled by that. So I'm asking your opinion about the difference between the palates. And then the next question is a logical wrap-up, is if anybody from either category wants to take advantage of your program, what is your contact information and what should they do? First of all, what about the difference in a male and a female palate?
It's interesting you bring up the difference in the male and the female palate, Anne, because I honestly don't think there is a huge amount of difference between men and women, although I've been told unofficially that you might be familiar with the term super taster, and that some people physiologically have denser, more sensitive taste buds on their tongues, and there are higher numbers of women super tasters than men, I have been told.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, I'm thinking, well, it's possible that perhaps women do have a higher propensity for tasting. I think what we've really set out to do is not, we don't disdain men. In fact, we love men. And we don't feel strongly that men or women, either one, are better tasters. What we simply want to do is encourage more women to feel more confident about developing their own palates in wine and food and being more confident in ordering better wine. So I hope that's a pretty,
right.
That's my personal feeling. And I would think it's pretty much the same for everybody that's involved with a woman's palate.
And then next up, if somebody, as either the grower or the consumer, wants to use the services of or the connections with a woman's palate, how to go about that and any contact information they may need.
The easiest thing to do is to go to our website at awomanspalate.com, and anyone who's interested in arranging for a seminar, attending a boot camp, learning more about the services that we offer, most of that is right there. My contact, Susan Citron, is information is there as well. And as far as growers or vintners, same thing. All they need to do is reach out to us or to me specifically, and we'd be happy to entertain them. We are bringing on additional vintners this year and do it sort of on an annual basis. So probably mid-year to summertime, we'll be looking to perhaps think of some additional vintners to bring on starting next year. But we've been really pleased that the group that we had initially assembled in 2010 has remained pretty much the same ever since.
Well,
it's a terrific group of very talented women.
Well, I wish you much success, Susan. I mean, you've worked so hard for everybody else, and I really hope this company takes off and that you advance this mission, which I wholeheartedly support.
Thank you, Anne. I so appreciate your interest, and we hope that we'll get more women interested in fine wine.
That's great. Thank you so much, Susan.
So there you have it for this week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week, for another On the Menu radio show about a different subject. And we'll leave you with a cliffhanger until then. See if you can guess what it is. And you won't guess, but never mind. It's time to go now. And what do we say before we go?
Bye-bye.